Good morning, everybody.
Greetings.
You know, it is it's Friday.
It's Friday. It's episode 210.
I mean, 210 has got a
it's got a good ring to it.
It's got a majesty to it.
Well, you know, I was thinking about because I just saw the other day, so you know, there's 420. Right, which is like the marijuana day. Well, now there's a psychedelic day, which is like 620, I think. And I don't know, somebody just obviously invented that. So when I saw 210, I was thinking about that. You know, 210 could be like the dawn of the new society day or something.
Yes. The age of Aquarius. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. 620, that means that like,
I don't know where that came from.
Jonas could ask, like, what do you want for Father's Day? And I could say, I want to go on a trip.
And that there you could go. Be, there you go.
Could be the thing.
Hey, Ellen.
Hey, Ellen.
There's Ellen, our wayward board member. forgetting meetings left and right.
We had a CPI board member board meeting last night. And yep. It was also Ellen's, was celebrating a fifth birthday, so that was the inside joke.
Ellen's only five. She's awfully mature.
Well, she was born in the leap year, so she's actually, 20?
That's right.
I guess. Okay, I'm going to shift. I'm Mark Van Steenhoek. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct Mike at the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing. We're talking about the problem of evil. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to shift another bad direction because I had this other realization this morning, which is that I think that the robot birds are causing the drought, because when there are no clouds, the robot birds can see and transmit farther. And they don't need food and water, so they don't really care. And so, yeah, so a cloudless sky is kind of like the perfect robot bird surveillance ecology.
So it's not man-made climate change or human-made climate change, it's bird-made climate change.
Well, except who made the robot birds?
That's like asking who made God. a larger robot bird made the robot bird. Back towards the beginning of time, at the center of the universe in the beginning of time was a robot bird.
Yeah,
praise it be.
One of the questions in Buddhism that you're not supposed to ask is, how did karma get started? And I think that this is kind of like that question. You know, you don't ask, how did the robot birds get started?
It's like that koan.
Don't ask.
It's that koan that doesn't translate well. Like, teacher, how does a cow reach enlightenment? Can a cow attain enlightenment? Moo, that one? Or is it dog? I can't remember. It only makes sense if you realize that moo means both no and something else. Like one of those koans. So like, teacher, how do I reach enlightenment? It would be like, chip, chip.
And that's it.
That's it. Like, okay, what do I do with that? Poof. It's a koan. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Back to the subject at hand. So the other thing I was thinking this morning was that and you mentioned this on Wednesday, you know, we did not start off this series by actually trying to define evil.
No.
Which is kind of a little hilarious. So I thought on day three, it would probably be maybe good to take a shot at that. And, You know, and even with this, I think we overcomplicate it. To me, evil has actually a very simple and obvious definition, right? And it's really anything that dehumanizes, right? So it's anything that dehumanizes, that stifles humanity. And this can be, you know, something we do to ourselves, obviously something we can do to each other. You know, it's even something that we can do to the environment, right? I mean, we look at the issue of climate change, right? We say, well, that maybe could be evil, but, you know, that's doing things maybe to other creatures more. And yet it is stifling humanity because, you know, as we run out of resources, as all kinds of difficult things happen, of course, people become more inhumane to each other.
I think, so, well, I mean, that's, I mean, it's, it is one of these hard concepts, like, you know, dehumanization, I think it is good. Like that fits the definition of oppression that I like to work with. I mean, I think it's, Simone Weil will say it's whenever people are turned into objects. It gets at that. And the nice thing I like about it is it takes away, it doesn't erase the idea of intention, but it doesn't center it on intention. It doesn't have to be a willful act, which is the important piece. And this gets to the systems theory stuff, what we're talking about with the banality of evil, that if we create systems that in a way think on their own, or they have their own logic that becomes, has its own momentum apart from individual will and intention, that dehumanizes it, still evil, even if intention is disconnected from it.
Yeah. So we've got some comments coming in already. That's awesome.
This one's interesting because it's controversial. Hey, controversial. Hey, one way you can tie your conversation on the question of evil to the Nazis is how Jung was a sympathizer, supporter. I mean, that's contested.
I was going to say, is that true?
It's one of these things, like there's papers written about this. It's not like Heidegger was like clearly a Nazi sympathizer.
Yeah. And Mahler and those folks.
You had people that continued, that did not flee the country and continue to work in German society through the Nazi years. And you could say that any of those people were Nazi sympathizers. But I mean, that's where Jung kind of fits. Like he didn't seem to be enthusiastic about it. And in some ways seemed to try to have autonomy in what he was doing and kind of keep the Nazis at bay. But at the same time, he was collaborating a bit, still working. So was he a Nazi? I think he was more mildly complicit, but at that point it's like, it's academic. You can see the way that some of his thought has been utilized by fascists. I mean, Jordan freaking Peterson is a Jungian, so I'm not wanting to.
Who's that?
Jordan Peterman. Jordy Ferguson.
Jordy Ferguson. Well, and you know, the way you describe that, right? So Jung stayed in Germany and continued to work. So it's like, okay, so are all of us who are staying in America and continuing to work and function as fascism is rising in America, are we all fascists? We're continuing to pay taxes. We're, you know.
Well, it gets more complicated because Jung was a very prominent figure and had some authority. So like what would be the proximal? It'd be like Fauci.
Well,
even just use Fauci under the Trump era was enacting the will of Trump, even though he was trying to resist it. Right. Is he part of the fascist apparatus?
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. It gets really incredibly complicated, doesn't it? Yeah. None of this is to like somehow excuse Jung. It just shows how complex all this is. Like, there's evil that he participated in. Even as his individual, like, let's assume he individually was not into it, because from what we read, he was not a overt supremacist. I'm sure there was all sorts of other stuff. But even as he's individually using his will to push against it, he can still be part of a system of the banality of evil. Like, this is why evil is so pernicious, and it doesn't have necessarily anything directly to do with your intention.
Well, and it's also where this, where I really resonate with this dehumanization idea, right? Because we all do know, and I think every, at least every person that I've talked to, you know, think about a job that you've had that is part of some sort of company or organization that you know is doing things that are not great. Right. And you can feel that, right? You, you know, you feel that when you go to work, or you feel that when you're at a meeting, or you feel that, you know, when you're talking to your boss, or you're getting some memo about some latest policy, and you just, you know, part of you kind of dies inside. And you're like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm part of this. I think Kathleen was talking about this at one point recently, maybe in a class. And, you know, and yet at the same time, you're also going, well, you know, one, I need to pay my bills. I can't just bail on every job where there's something dehumanizing going on, because I probably couldn't have any job if I did that. And two, then there's the whole thing of like, well, if I leave, that can't change, right? And so, you know, so I'm going to stick around to try to make it better. So then there's that tension that we all feel in that. And I think that's where there's that rub between the individual and a system. And there's where we feel it. Like, we're being crushed by the system, even as we have some agency, but we also recognize that probably the amount of agency we have is far less than what we'd like to have.
Oh, we already got that one. James touching back in the beginning, robot turtles all the way down. No, it's birds.
It's birds, James.
You weren't paying attention.
turtles are real.
Kathleen writes, and this is an interesting question. Yes. Are you saying that evil and sin are the same things? I don't think they are, but as I read that question, I'm thinking, like, where would I draw the line? Because they're interrelated ideas. And this gets into, like, conservatives will kind of collapse them. Because if we go with Dan's definition, which I don't think is necessarily the perfect be-all, end-all definition, but it really is functional, anything that dehumanizes, I can hear a conservative saying, well, if you're a dude and you have sex with another dude, you're dehumanizing yourself, so it's evil. That's how they probably go with that.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, so then when we use a term like dehumanizing, we have to define that. What does that mean, right? And, very clearly what one person thinks is dehumanizing, another person might disagree with. I would say that evil and sin are in many ways synonyms. You know, that especially on a systemic level, right, that, you know, when we're talking about the principalities and powers, we're definitely talking about this spiritual systemic reality that is oppressive. It'd be certainly interesting to
Use
that out more.
My sense would be to try to see it as a Venn diagram, where some sin can be evil when it becomes to the point where you're participating in the destruction of others for your own pleasure, would be kind of how where I might want to go with evil. And sin, like, is when you are falling short of what is full and mature and full of life.
Yeah, which again could in some ways is dehumanizing.
Yeah, so then that's where it's a Venn diagram. Right? Yeah. To me, they're two separate concepts, and I'm trying to think, like, it'd be interesting, like, how those two clusters of words, because I mean, I don't assume that there's just one word for sin and one word for evil throughout all scripture. Yeah. But if someone were to map out, and this would be fascinating, I'm sure someone's done this, like how those used words are used differently to express different and maybe overlapping ideas. But I feel like they're not exactly the same. Otherwise, to me, they're talking about different things oftentimes. But how and why it gets really nuanced. So it's a fascinating question. And I think for our purposes, we tend to, in our society, use sin as an interpersonal morality language, and evil tends to be used more in a sort of like broader destructive, like very, there's a violence to evil that you might not assume is involved in sin. So, but again, it's overlapping ideas. And
yeah,
that's fascinating.
It's good. Good thing.
So people want to weigh in on that. That'd be great. Ellen writes, I was super surprised to learn Hasatan was the Persian jester. I always thought Satan was the prosecutor. I guess that's just modern Hebrew, though. There isn't a sense of an accuser kind of thing developed. So I think it does shift from court or court jester to prosecutor or accuser language, which is still similar. You can see a drift there maybe going on.
No, I mean, and, you know, and that's when we were talking about this on Wednesday, I mean, that's this whole business of syncretic development, right, of thought, is that things change over time. And, you know, we can watch the evolution of these words, of theological concepts. It's really interesting.
So, yeah, Ellen says, on the topic of Satan, I like to say Satan doesn't need an advocate, defense attorney, since Satan is a prosecutor, the accuser. We're going to have to adjust for jester understanding. I don't know, like, that's, again, like, how much the jester understanding still continues on from Persia to, especially as you move from kind of earlier Judaism towards Second Temple Judaism, like the time of Jesus, like how, because there's still a continual drift. Like, so in the Hebrew scriptures, you don't have this developed idea of Satan nearly as much as you have in the New Testament. It's much more prominent, which is, again, exciting and fascinating to show, see that line of thinking. And it always troubles evangelicals when you do that, which makes it even more fun.
Well, and, you know, part of that, we can understand how that happens, right? Because, you know, as... I mean, sure, Jerusalem maybe has sort of petty kings as, you know, the Roman Empire develops. But but really, it doesn't have like a big head honcho king, right, like Persia would have. And so, you know, within particularly Pharisaic thought and the temple world, things become much more about legalities, right? Because you don't, you know, the emperor is the king. And so if you start in your own little world, if you're going to think about these different terms, right? Well, what's the predominant area that you're allowed to function in? Well, it's this law, right? So something like a court jester could easily become a prosecutor, because that's your world. You don't have the authority of a king. Don't skip over this. Cheryl clapped for us twice. So
Cheryl. Neil says, and so here we land in the systemic nature of evil.
About that.
Tom writes, the definition of evil as anything that dehumanizes strikes me as very anthropocentric. Yeah, that's fair. I don't have a good, better definition of evil, but it seems like centering humanity within the global ecosystem has been a big part of the problem. I feel like, Dan, you tried to adjust with that, saying like, and maybe it's like...
Well, see, I actually do think that evil is anthropocentric. Because, you know, we talked about this on Monday, when somebody was talking about tornadoes or whatever. I mean, you know, when a tree falls in the forest and let's say, you know, crushes some bugs or a little rabbit or something like that, is that evil? No, I don't think that's evil. Is it a bummer for those bugs or the rabbit? Well, yeah, I guess. So evil, and this is particularly true within our tradition, but I would say even within other spiritual traditions. I mean, Buddhism doesn't use the term evil, but it uses the term confusion, and uses it in much the same way. And so evil arises because of human consciousness. And so yeah, I mean, that, and that then begins a whole flow of dehumanization, right? So Cain kills Abel, or the other way around. I always forget which one. Shows what a great biblical scholar I am. And definitely part of what is evil is how human beings relate to the environment, in the sense that that impinges upon the humanity of other people, and also now we see ourselves, right? That we are becoming more and more dehumanized. And I think this is the rise of fascism. We've talked about this before, that when you stress a system, a human system, fascism is often the result.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually don't have any problem with evil being very human centered.
So what about, I think the question kind of goes at this, like, let's do a thought experiment. You discover an island that humans never have been to and never will, and you decide to torture all the flora and fauna, and it doesn't affect anybody but yourself. Would it still be evil?
Well, yeah, because in order to, I would suggest that in order to, and we certainly, when we talk about, for example, America, right, and slavery and the genocide of Native folks, you know, we've talked a lot about white people being malformed, right, which is a dehumanization process. In order to torture something, you have to be malformed. You have to not be human. if you're human, if you have compassion, if you understand your connection to all living things, you don't want to torture things. And so, yeah, so I actually think that's a great example, that the human being brings evil to that island and enacts evil things, but it's coming as a result of the dehumanization process that has to occur in order for torture to occur.
More comments coming here.
A lot of comments.
Gus says, on the topic of jobs that are terrible, David Graeber's final book, Bullshit Jobs, explores this idea in some great ways.
Yes. On the Rise of Bullshit Jobs is an awesome, it was initially a little article, then he made it into a book. Really, really good.
Schiller writes, systems thinking. Can you all share your favorite systems thinkers, writers, back to evil?
Gus, the librarian, could handle that one. Yeah, there's, Cheryl, if you want to message me, I would be happy to share the bibliography I put together for my course on systems thinking with you.
There are a lot of them. I don't know if this isn't good. I'm reading because I'm doing a systems, social systems and spirituality class. And I'm looking at it mostly from the way that social systems can form us. And like, here's one that I've been starting to dig into that I think is interesting. How this might look backwards to everyone. How Institutions Think, by Mary Douglas. She was an anthropologist. She draws off of Durkheim. So a lot of these anthropologists and sociologists from the last 50 years have started to engage systems thinking. There's a pure discipline of systems theory, which I don't find as exciting. I like the more the implication stuff. So a lot of the stuff, like people like Walter Wink, William Stringfellow, we wouldn't say they're systems thinkers formally, but they're talking about the way in which social systems have spiritual qualities. And so those are some of the places that I would kind of generally look at.
Yeah, and if you want, that book reminded me, if you want a fun little book on systems issues that really is very sort of tongue-in-cheek but hilarious, check out, and it's very short, it's a book called Orbiting the Giant Hairball.
Orbiting the Giant Hairball.
Okay. Yeah, and there are great illustrations to it too.
Tom writes, maybe evil is, and this is this could be a good definition, unnecessary harm to other living things.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if maybe a way of framing it of crushing sacred things. Maybe that could be a broader way of framing it.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Where do you draw the line? Because it raises questions about personhood.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been all sorts of conversations about like which other forms of life do we grant personhood and rights to? Yeah. It's a really fascinating area of exploration.
Yeah. Well, and Tom, your definition really gets at what the Jainists do. And so Jainism is a particular sect of Hinduism, and basically one of their central credos is they literally try to kill nothing, right? So they eat fruits and vegetables that you can get without killing plants. They don't like killing bugs. Because they deem, you know, any killing to be unnecessary harm and therefore evil. And so that's, you know, that's a fairly what we might call extreme, but it's an interesting sort of view of that.
Stefan writes, yeah, dehumanizing oneself, lol, like Kant. Who thought masturbation violates the categorical imperative. Yeah. I guess he can't masturbate. Ellen writes, I think evil is like the nothing and the never-ending story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what's his name? The guy that wrote The Road Less Traveled, not The Road Less Traveled.
M. Scott Peck?
Yeah, M. Scott Peck. So his definition of evil was basically lying, right?
Children of the lie.
Yeah, the children of the people of the lie. Yeah. And, you know, and that's an interesting book. I mean, he kind of goes through it and he's, you know, it comes out of his own clinical practice where he's really, you know, he felt that every once in a while he encountered people who he would not just describe as mentally ill, but who he would describe as being possessed by evil. And he was really trying to talk about that and think about what that was. And no, so
one of the early examples he gives in that book, which is, it's a fascinating study. Like these parents, the older brother had committed suicide with a gun, and like, a couple of years later, the second son, they gave that gun to him for his birthday.
Right.
And so this is an example of like, look, that's evil. That's not just messed up in a broad way. But there was a way in which they were finding, it was a type of narcissism that is bent on destroying others for joy. Like, it's so messed. I'm trying to imagine what happened with that kid.
Yeah.
James writes, how would you relate evil to, quote, the world, the flesh, and the devil, end quote? It seems to me that we can look at evil through a personal and social and spiritual lens.
Yeah, well, I think we need, I mean, those are all categories or aspects of reality or ways of describing things. And yeah, and I think that we can look at this through all those lenses, but they're also all interconnected.
Yeah, and I think part of the shift that maybe, you know, that I think Dan and I are kind of alluding to, and we're not at all unique in this, but there is a tendency among more traditional or conventional approaches to Christianity to see sin as falling short of what God wants for you. So it's being disobedient. That's the operative framework. And so using the masturbation of Kant example, like, oh, that's not ideal. So that's sin. You know what else is sin? Murder, genocide. They're both wrong, and in fact all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, so all sins are the same. That is like that way of thinking, which is ridiculous. That's ridiculous. You know, and then you get more progressive or liberal tendencies which would want to focus on systemic, and so there's this tendency to like send, well, you know, it's got to be a both and. I'm like, no, I don't think it's a both and exactly like that. I think there has to be a fairly coherent way of understanding how these things interconnect, not just like, well, the liberals are right, it's bad to do genocide, and the conservatives are right that it's bad to masturbate. We need to be perfect in all areas. It's like, no, I think that's failing to understand the root of it, which is God is calling us to full life, And there are things that trammel and impede upon that and crush other and crush life. And we need to be pay attention to what does that. Ed writes, is evil systemic while sin is more individually based? I mean, that's some way of dicing, but I feel like I want to resist that. But we talk about sinful humanity, so I don't know. Again, I feel like that falls too much into this. Well, sin is the, I have unsavory, unwholesome thoughts towards my neighbor's wife. And then evil is, I mean, because of that, I'm going to go commit genocide against her people. Like that kind of way, that way of slicing it just doesn't seem satisfactory. There has to be more of a dynamic way. And again, this is where I think a study would be fascinating for anyone out there who's doing that work. That seems to be how a lot of people will talk about it, though. James writes, put another way, I don't have a problem with describing the powers as psychosocial entities and systems, but I'm not sure they can't be actual spirits as well.
Oh, I think they are spirits. There is a spiritual reality that is undergirding things. And, you know, and to me, I mean, my experience of what is happening in America is not just that it's a psychosocial disintegration. I mean, when I hear some of the things that Trump and his followers say, I feel a demonic force. I mean, I feel evil behind this. And I think that again, to me, and the spiritual life talks about this all the time, that there are these different levels of reality that are all intermingling and interconnected, and that we give the fullest description of what is going on by looking at all of them. Now,
Ed writes, maybe the intentionality is key. And this question of intention, it comes up a lot, and I feel like I'm still thinking about it. Like, I don't want to dismiss the role of intentions, but I want to recognize that one, human beings have more than one intention at any given time about almost anything.
Yeah.
And we're self-deceived about it. So a lot of times our actions betray things that are not intentional, and it still doesn't make it less problematic if you intend to harm or not.
We don't have nearly as much clear intention as we think we do.
But at the same time, intention is important, because once you realize the truth, you have to use whatever will and make whatever choices you meaningfully can to remedy. Otherwise, we're kind of fucked. Like, and a lot of people would say that we're bound and we can't, everything is deterministic. And I don't think that's true. I just don't think it's as much on intentionality as we often think.
Yeah, and I think one of the ways we see this, one of the ways that we see this is when, you know, people who get into activism get depressed and burn out because they have some realization, they have some now intentions to do good and to fix things and to help, and they start trying to do stuff, and they see, well, nothing much changes, and then they get really bummed out. And part of that, I mean, some of that for white people is a whiteness issue. But some of it is this mythology that our intention, you know, can move mountains, right? And you have all this ridiculous, you know, fundy stuff. Like, I just saw something this morning, and it's so sad. Like, if all the pastors in Uganda prayed together with one accord, there would be no COVID in Uganda in a week. I mean, somebody actually said this, like, he really believes this, seriously. And I mean, it's absurd, right? It's absurd. So, but there is this mythology that humans develop about our own power of intention. And it's just not as powerful as we think it is. It's important, but I would argue that it's mostly important for ourselves. Like, do I at least have enough intention to direct my own life? Like, and a lot of times we find out we can't even direct our own lives the way that we would like to. So how are we going to direct the life of the world? But all right, well, I see that we're getting
past. We're gonna
blaze through.
You know, this is a good point. Stefan says, as someone who majored in philosophy and theodicy and philosophy, evil is usually identified with suffering, or at least egregious suffering, and the problem is divided into the problem of moral evil, i.e. the suffering inflicted by persons, and natural evil, i.e. suffering inflicted by natural processes such as tornadoes, etc., and separate questions of why an omni-God allows them are discussed. You know, and I know that that's, you know, and in, yeah. in the Hebrew scriptures, yeah. evil is used like to talk about natural calamities. And there's reasons for that. I tend to want to shy away from that because we tend to always assume evil has a causing agent. And because of that, if there's a tornado, then God is the causing agent. And I just find that really, at least practically unhelpful. But again, this is where we get into these broad concepts, and it shows like our language is insufficient sometimes to talk about these realities in a way that help us grapple with them. But yeah.
And Tom's next comment kind of relates to this.
If God/the universe wipes out an island of living things with a volcanic eruption, is it evil? Does it matter if humans were present?
Yeah. See, and I would say that is not evil. That's not helpful, I don't believe, to define that as evil. Change and transformation and material appearing and destruction is a perfectly natural, normal part of the universal process. You know?
Yeah. And then there's these questions. If we're like, let's talk about the Hurricane Katrina for a second. Like, where's the evil in that? Is it the tornado or the hurricane? Is it in government response? Is it in the socioeconomic realities that cause people who are poor to live in
right.
places that are more susceptible to damage and have less mobility yes. to flee from problems? Like,
yes.
there's That's so much to learn
where the
about
evil that. Is.
Yeah. And so if we get bogged down in talking about calamity as being a like God is the moral evil agent, which a lot of people want to do, it can sometimes eclipse these other issues. Like, why is it that these human beings were vulnerable to this? And we can talk about that. And maybe we can talk about it all as evil, but then it gets to be too broad of a concept to be meaningful in our conversation. So a lot of this is maybe we're using words in different ways and it's semantics, but this is part of the task of how do we move forward in a way in talking about this so that we understand in light of these problems and suffering, how we relate to one another, ourselves, the land and God, and move all those things towards fullness and wholeness and what impedes that. It's kind of these ethical kind of considerations. Neil writes, I'm with James. I don't think it's any one thing. How many things and what they are called becomes the question, then, I suppose. Yeah, that's what we're grappling with.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Ellen writes, three ways to think about actions with harmful results: rebellion, suffering, or simply different.
Okay.
And I wish we had more time to expound on those because that's,
yeah,
it's like there's a lot more there. Ed writes, Matthew Fox has a book on the sins of the flesh and the sins of the spirit. Aquinas says sins of the flesh or weakness lead us back to God, while sins of the spirit like violence, lying, lead us away from God. You can see there being...
Yeah, we can talk a lot about that. Yeah.
So much there. So when you start talking about suffering and how that is a part of processes, it's fascinating. Gregory writes, disillusionment equals losing our illusions.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's a stage of it for sure.
Do I have a commitment to doing right regardless of the outcome, or is my sense of right based on immediate results? Again, this ethics, like these questions of what does it mean to do moral or ethical acts in the world and why? Ellen writes, rebellion being the stand-in for intentions.
There we go.
I feel like we're just kind of
all right.
scraped the surface of a big thing and we're done for the week. So we solved the problem of evil.
Avoided fascism all in one shot.
Welcome.
All right, well, thank you everyone, as always, just great comments. So good to have everybody with us, and hope you have a good weekend, and stay undercover from the robot birds.
They're always watching.
They're always watching.